From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Johnson & Johnson makes baby shampoo and Band-Aids. It's also a big pharmaceutical company. From 1994 to 2008, its antipsychotic drug, Risperdal, brought in $30 billion. It was approved for adults. But according to muckraking journalist Stephen Brill, the company illegally and aggressively marketed the drug to children and the elderly, knowing they were vulnerable to serious side effects and making billions even after fines and settlements. This hour on Point, Johnson & Johnson, and what happens if a pharmaceutical company puts sales above health? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are we staying on top of industry ethics in this country? Pharmaceutical industry ethics. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Before we go to Johnson & Johnson, there's another big drug company story in the news. Companies vastly jacking up the prices of drugs, medicines. Turing Pharmaceuticals just hiked the price of the drug Daraprim, which treats a parasitic infection, from $13.50 a tablet to $750 a tablet. Outrage has followed, and it's not alone. Andrew Pollack has been covering the story for the New York Times and joins us now from Los Angeles. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Tom.
When was the price hike? Why was the price hike from $13.50 to $750?
Turing acquired this drug called Daraprim in August and raised the price shortly thereafter. That this is sort of a business strategy for Turing and for certain other companies where they're looking for these older, neglected drugs that they can then raise the price so that they are more sort of in line with the costs of more modern drugs for rare diseases, which are very expensive.
What does Daraprim treat, Andrew?
It treats a condition called toxoplasmosis. It's a parasitic infection that's foodborne. Many people have this parasite, but it doesn't hurt them at all if your immune system functions, but it can be very serious for babies whose moms get infected during pregnancy and for people with compromised immune systems like those with AIDS or certain cancer patients.
This drug has been around for 62 years. It was selling for $13.50 a tablet. A hike like that has brought outrage first from those in the medical world and now much more widely. I mean, it looks from the outside like just charge what you can. And when you say bring it in line with prices for other drugs, it gives, I think, regular consumers the impression that just charge any darn price you can possibly ask and just trust the system will pay it or people will suffer.
Well, that is, you know, how drug pricing has been, that the drug manufacturers can fairly well set their price. It depends, of course, if there's competition, then that limits their ability to do that. In this case, there's not really good competition at the moment for that drug. So they can set a price that they like. And then, you know, some insurers might try to push back and not pay for it. And typically, insurers get some discount, and Medicaid will get a big discount on this under federal rules. But yes, prices can be set by the drug manufacturer, and it's a bit of a black box how exactly they decide this.
Do we have a system, Andrew, that's just set up for exploitation with the way responsibility lies here, there, nowhere? Health insurance companies pay a lot of it. It remains invisible often. I mean, is there no speed bump when this 32-year-old guy comes in as the head of this company, and he's kind of been down this road before, hedge fund guy, and he just says, okay, you know, $13.50 to $700, here we go.
Well, I mean, it's been said that typical market forces do not work that well in the pharmaceutical industry. Competition doesn't seem to lower prices that much. This, you know, Turing is not the only company that has done this. This is a very unusual price hike. I think even for your more standard drugs, I mean, it's fairly typical for brand name pharmaceuticals to have their price, at least their list price, increased by 10% or more year after year. That's certainly not uncommon. Now, again, what insurers pay is a little less than the list price, but still they're negotiating down from what the list price is. So if your list price goes up 10% a year, even your discounted price is likely to go up a similar amount.
In this case, it's something like 5,000%, and it's not the only one. You've got a real outcry from doctors. You've got politicians talking about it, now Hillary Clinton and more. I don't know a simple way of putting this, but you follow this, Andrew. Do we have a system in which we're just getting screwed by the drug companies who can and do raise prices to any level at whim?
They can raise their prices quite high, and there is not that much of an effective countermeasure in most cases. That is true.
Is there any move to change that, or is that just the way it is, just the way it goes in this country?
Well, there's, you know, I think there's a growing concern over these drug prices. I mean, in this particular case, the first people to sound the alarm were the infectious disease doctors who noticed this. And that by itself is fairly new, that you've had now cancer doctors publicly protesting the price of cancer drugs. You've had cardiologists now saying they're going to start looking at prices of drugs, costs when they evaluate what treatment to use. That's unusual because in the past, doctors basically said, I'm going to use the best drug, and I'm not going to care about the cost. And in fact, many of them never even knew the cost. So you have a rise in consciousness. You have a lot of, you have this political pressure now building. Hillary Clinton's announcing her plan today. I mean, the prospects for that probably depend on whether she can get elected or not. Mm-hmm. But you're seeing, you know, more pressure on, more of an uproar on prices for more sectors than before. Whether that leads to some change is still hard to tell.
Andrew Pollack with the New York Times. Andrew, your reporting has gotten a lot of people's attention and focused it right here. Thank you very much for that and for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Now, for the Johnson & Johnson story, you probably know the story best for its commercial or consumer product, just a little video of an adorable baby in a bubble bath.
The touch of your hands is stimulating her senses, nurturing her mind, and helping her development. So why just clean your baby when you can give her so much more?
There's the Johnson. Yummy face of Johnson & Johnson. Lawyer and muckraking journalist and entrepreneur Stephen Brill has been all over a different Johnson & Johnson story. Brill is founder of Court TV and American Lawyer magazine. He's author of America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System, and of the huge expose running now on Huffington Post. It's headlined America's Most Admired Lawbreaker. 8 of 15 parts of his Johnson & Johnson story have been posted to the Huffington Post website. You can link to it at onpointradio.org. We invited Johnson & Johnson on with Steve Brill today. They did not respond. Stephen Brill, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure. I'd just like to add a little bit to the discussion you had, since, as you know, much of my book about Obamacare is about how it came to be that drug prices, prescription drug prices in this country, uniquely around the world, are the only prices that are not regulated. We're the
Go
only
for it.
Country
where are we
that doesn't
headed?
Do something about this. Well, the problem is very simple. We give drugs like the one you were just talking about a patent. A patent is a government grant of a monopoly. In every other country in the world, when drugs get a patent, what comes with it is some control over their pricing. In this country, there isn't. And when all the lobbying was being done to pass the Affordable Care Act, the Democrats in Congress and the White House made a deal with the pharmaceutical companies, which is, we won't do anything about this situation. We won't put something in the law, for example, that would allow Medicare to negotiate prices, or that would allow there to be the kind of price controls there are in every other country in the world. We won't touch that if you support the Affordable Care Act. And the pharmaceutical companies organized PACs and did television ads supporting the Affordable Care Act, which the good news about the Affordable Care Act is it gave tens of millions of people access to health care, which is a terrific thing. The not-so-good news is they got access to health care to pay the same exorbitant prices for things like drugs that the rest of us has been have been paying. And what this company did in this particular situation, it happens to be something, you know, that the New York Times picked up, but this is happening every day. And, you know, they could have made the price $750. Mm-hmm. They could have made the price, $75,000. And no one could do anything about it uniquely in this country.
We are going to keep track of that, Steve Brill. I mean, we followed it for some time, but the stories have become so head-spinning lately that we wanted to touch on it today.
Well, I think, as I say at the end of the book, I think this is one of the looming problems, you know, post-Obamacare is that, and I wrote this, the book came out in January, that the cost of drugs, the escalating cost of prescription drugs is going to be in the headlines for this year and next year and the year after. And in fact, that's why I ended up doing this story about Johnson & Johnson, which more than anything else is a drug company. And I just wanted to look at how a drug company, in this case, the most admired healthcare country in the world, according to all the surveys that are done, how they comport themselves. And what I found in the case of Risperdal and in some other drugs that they market, they don't comport themselves very well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about a story of a drug pushed too far for profit by the pharmaceutical industry. And a big expose by muckraking journalist Stephen Brill on the iconic Johnson & Johnson, which he says put sales over science, sales above the law in its handling of a drug called Risperdal. You may have heard of it. All the way back in 2009, CBS was reporting. This is Cheryl Atkinson talking to a family whose son began taking Risperdal when he was 7 years old for attention deficit disorder. This was off-label use.
Once taking Risperdal, John's mom says he became aggressive, sleepy, and developed bowel problems. But the biggest shock came when he was 14 and started developing women's breasts.
For a 14-year-old boy, that has to be horribly embarrassing.
He asked me, was he a girl?
He asked if he was a girl.
He tried to put on his sister's bra.
And it wasn't just the boy in that news story in 2009. You may have heard this. San Francisco law firm Gerard Gibbs putting out an ad last year seeking claims from parents of boys who had taken Risperdal.
If your son took Risperdal and then developed gynecomastia, a condition where boys develop enlarged breasts, you may have a claim for money damages.
And there have been a lot of damages and penalties. $6 billion, Steve Brill estimates, but Johnson & Johnson has made billions, so it's worked out all right. The guy who led the marketing of this drug is now head of the company. Steve Brill, tell us the story. What happened here?
Well, what happened, as you've described it, is that back in the early 90s, Johnson & Johnson needed a drug to replace its first blockbuster psychotic drug called Haldol, which was coming off patent. And it created this drug called Risperdal. But when the government approved it, the government said it's a powerful drug and the risks attendant to the drug are such that that it can only be prescribed for adults who aren't elderly, who have severe psychosis, not to children, not to the elderly. And from the very beginning, as I reveal with all the documents, when you go online to read the article, you can also click through and read, for example, the 1994 rollout business plan that Johnson & Johnson put together that declared that the market for the approved label, severe psychosis, was much too small and it had to expand that market. In other words, it had to sell off-label, had to promote the drug in nursing homes for elderly people who were restless and had trouble sleeping, had to promote the drug to children who had ADD or ADHD or other behavior disorders. And what I've put together is the saga of how they did that, all the internal emails, how the FDA kept pushing back and warning them, don't do this, don't do this, but they kept doing it. And ultimately, a whistleblower comes forward 8 years later, whose story I document, and you know, the government gets interested. They actually wire her, as I report in one of the chapters, to monitor the conduct, in this case where they're having a meeting about how to sell this drug to the elderly, which they're not supposed to do. One of the reasons I pick this story of this drug is, first of all, there's exquisite detail about it that I was able to get by reading thousands and thousands of pages of legal documents and trial transcripts. But the second really intriguing thing was, with all the discussion today about holding corporate executives responsible, the government will usually say, well, gee, if someone's a very high up CEO, how can we prove under the appropriate burdens of proof that you have to overcome to prove a crime, how can we prove that a high up executive in a big corporation actually knew about this? Well, it turns out that during the time of all this conduct, the sales manager for Risperdal and then the president of the Johnson & Johnson unit that was selling Risperdal is the guy who is now the CEO of the company. So at the same time that the board of Johnson & Johnson is negotiating a $2.2 billion settlement with the government over all this illegal marketing of Risperdal, they are voting to promote him to be the CEO of the company based on, according to their public statements, how marvelously he met all his sales targets and business plans on his way up the ladder.
You got a 48% raise last year to $25 million.
Right. So here's a case where you can actually make the argument, because there are all kinds of emails you can click through if you read this, and all kinds of business plans, and I'm in deposition transcripts where Alex Gorsky, the CEO of the company, is directly involved in supervising exactly the conduct that the company pled guilty to.
It is a very rich example.
And yet he's not held responsible. No, the corporation is held responsible.
He's at the top of the ladder with a great big raise, $25 million it came to last year. And yes, he's right there, CEO. It's an amazing example of expose journalism at Huffington Post. You can link to it through our website, onpointradio.org, and all kinds of links out from Steve Brill's very, very detailed story to all the documents and images. It's we'll talk about that format. I mean, you're not denying, no one's denying that for its prescribed or on-label use, Risperdal is a good drug, that it's effective and helps people. Is that right?
Well, exactly. You know, here's the issue, and it goes back to the conversation that you started about the pricing of drugs. If you have no regulation, no real oversight, and you develop a drug that is a really good drug for 0.5% to 1% of the population who are suffering from this kind of a severe mental illness, but you then see that, you know, gee, I can sell this pill for $3 or $4 or $5, and it cost me 2 cents. And instead of having a $400 million market, if I adhere to the FDA's label, I can have a $1.5 billion market, and all of that revenue basically flows to the bottom line as profit. The temptation becomes too much, and in most situations where you have that kind of billions of dollars worth of temptation with potentially dangerous products, there is a regulatory scheme in place that is meant to handle that. But here, as I've just said, the person in charge suffers no consequence. The corporation pleads guilty. Now, what happens when a corporation pleads guilty? Do they put the building in jail or the corporate seal in jail? The corporation pays a fine, which means the shareholders pay a fine. If you're in a pension plan, the odds are very high that your pension plan has Johnson & Johnson stock because it's a good basic blue chip stock that most pension plans own. That means that you, the person I'm talking to, paid that fine, not the people who are responsible for the conduct. So there's no sense of individual responsibility, and yet you're dealing with billions and billions and billions of dollars in profit, which in this case makes the career of someone. He becomes the CEO of the company based on his performance.
They've sold $30 billion.
And that is very troubling, but I also think it's emblematic of In many ways, the regulatory regime of the entire pharmaceutical industry, it's as if, which by the way exists on an honor system. You know, a lot of people think of the FDA as a place where there are thousands of doctors running around in lab coats and testing drugs. As I point out, what the FDA does, it takes data from the drug companies and analyzes their data from the studies that they pay to be conducted. They read articles. The FDA reads articles in medical journals. That, as I point out in the article, Johnson & Johnson has paid doctors to write those articles. So it's this huge honor system, and the consequences and the potential consequences are really severe.
$30 billion in sales globally of Risperdal for Johnson & Johnson. By your estimate, I guess $18 billion in profit top line in the United States.
Well, it's actually, it would be more. It's $30 billion around the world. Mm-hmm. It's $20 billion in the United States, of which $18 billion is profit. So if you have to pay $6 billion in penalties and fines to make $18 billion in profit, everyone listening to us right now would sign up for that deal.
Even shareholders, so you say, get penalized, but they're still making out all right there. Here's what I don't understand, Steve. Off-label use. What's legal and what's not? I mean, doctors prescribe drugs off-label with some regularity.
Which they can do.
So what's
the
wrongdoing
exactly?
Which the
law says they can do. Now, this is an interesting topic, and I tell you, along with the issue of the pricing of drugs, this is going to become a headline issue this year and next, which is it's sort of a Citizens United kind of First Amendment issue for drug companies.
Okay.
The drug companies, Johnson & Johnson included, are now taking the position that while the FDA says if we approve a drug for XYZ disease in this population, that's the only way you can try to promote it. Mm-hmm. The drug companies are saying, well, we have a First Amendment right. If we're passionate about a drug, we have a First Amendment right to communicate our passion to doctors about how well the drug works in populations that you, the FDA, haven't approved it for. Now, the original FDA regulations were written at a time in the 1960s, just after the scandal involving the thalidomide drug, a drug which was used off-label by pregnant women in Europe that produced thousands of horrifically deformed babies. So the law about off-label was meant to control the conduct where the FDA would approve a drug for some narrow use, but the drug company, now having the approval, would go and promote it for lots of other uses. And the rationale here is that we might take a drug like Risperdal and say it's very powerful. It has some really potentially bad side effects. But if someone is severely psychotic and about to commit suicide, it's worth the risk. That is a different risk analysis than saying my 8-year-old kid acts up in school because he has ADD. Why don't you give him some Risperdal?
Steve, take us to the lawbreaking. Your headline is America's Most Admired Lawbreaker. And I still... So doctors can prescribe, but what is it exactly? Where did
drug companies
where did Johnson & Johnson go wrong in promoting
the law,
selling?
The law, the statute says that a drug company cannot misbrand a drug, and the definition of that is that if the label says it's for schizophrenic adults, the company cannot promote it for behavioral disorders in children.
But they went to town on promoting it to seniors and children. Describe how Johnson
Well, they were told not to promote it to the elderly. There are all these documents that you can click through in the article where the FDA says, don't promote it to the elderly. You have a brochure that you're handing out at nursing homes for doctors and attendants at nursing homes, the headline of which is hostile on the outside, fragile on the inside. And it's meant to be used in nursing homes, to put patients to sleep at night. And it says specifically, you can't be saying that. You can't be doing that. And instead, Johnson & Johnson establishes a specific elder care sales unit to do exactly that.
136 strong people.
Right. All around the country, going around to doctors. And now that's not my interpretation of the facts. Johnson & Johnson pled guilty to those facts.
And for underage users, for children, boys included?
For underage users, the company paid for all kinds of medical journal articles. They established a $2 million center for the study of child behavior disorders at Harvard Mass General, got a very prominent child psychiatrist there to run the center, and lo and behold, they produced material and gave speeches about how effective Risperdal was in treating children with behavior disorders at the same time that the label specifically excluded using it in children.
Johnson & Johnson didn't respond. We invited them on. I have read in Nick Christoph's piece in the Times over the weekend, a spokesman, Ernie Nowitz, vehemently disagreeing with your take on this, denying a cover-up, saying Risperdal is a useful drug, real benefits. What about the argument that they might make? I don't know that. Look,
well, he's right. It is a useful drug. It does have real benefits. The issue is it's a useful drug that, according to the FDA, I'm not an expert,
yeah,
but according to the regulatory authorities, it had real benefits for half to 1% of the population, and they wanted to sell it to 4 or 5 or 10% of the population.
The risk in seniors was stroke, I guess, and in children.
And diabetes.
Diabetes, okay. For young people, the risk was primarily to young males, and
young males developed large female breasts. There's a case that I write about that I take the readers through in some detail.
Mm-hmm.
That was completed in Philadelphia last winter, that resulted in a $2.5 million verdict against Johnson & Johnson. That young boy in Alabama grew 46 double D breasts.
Now,
and the jury, I interviewed the jury forewoman. The jury decided that Johnson & Johnson had failed to warn the doctor of those risks and that the cause of his 46 double D breasts was his taking of Risperdal after the doctor had not been warned.
I'm not a doctor. I don't know what the standards are. The Johnson & Johnson study you report found that 5.5% of boys had this side effect of developing large breasts.
Well, it found 5.5% of boys.
Okay.
Their own data said 5.5% of boys, but the label, when this youngster in Alabama took the drug and his doctor was looking at the label said it was rare, and the definition, the FDA definition that every doctor knows of rare means occurring in 0.1% of cases or less. So 5.5% is, 50 times more than 0.1%.
What exactly did Johnson & Johnson plead guilty to?
The crime of misbranding, which, as I've said, mm-hmm, is promoting the drug off-label to the elderly. They settled the civil side of the claims about the children.
And the leader of this marketing push, Alex Gorsky, is now CEO of the company. Is there any sign,
correct,
that Johnson & Johnson or any other drug industry player out there is looking at this story and saying, we don't want to go there? Or were the profits so good, even after all the trouble, that why not?
Well, in fact, the other drug companies have all in the recent past, the last decade, pleaded and negotiated civil settlements for similar marketing transgressions, but none really as serious as with the drug Risperdal, that kind of drug as widespread and as powerful as the drug was, and certainly none where the sales manager became the CEO of the company.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about a story of a drug pushed too far for profit, Stephen Brill says, in the pharmaceutical industry. A big expose by muckraking journalist Steve Brill on the iconic Johnson & Johnson, which he says put sales over science, sales above the law. The whole series is going up piece by piece at Huffington Post. There's a lot there already. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. America's Most Admired Lawbreaker is the headline. Risperdal worked for a lot of people. Its on-label use was adults, not seniors and not kids. Off-label, a lot of push there by Johnson & Johnson as well. They may end up paying $6 billion in settlements for misconduct here. And there's penalties and more, but billions in profit remain. Stephen Brill talked with Benita Pledger, lives in Thorsby, Alabama, about her son Austin, who was diagnosed at age 5 with autism, began taking Risperdal in second grade. With every increase in his dose, he gained weight.
My first thought when his breast started growing, I thought, how unfortunate that this is happening to him, because so many times young men can be overweight and they don't have breast.
So should that have happened? Steve Brill says, no, no way. But there's a lot of profit here anyway. The guy who led this push is now CEO of Johnson & Johnson, Alex Gorsky. He was a featured speaker early this year at Wharton School and was asked about his style of decision-making. This is kind of telling here. He talked about an instance where Johnson & Johnson made a recommendation about a product. And listen, he's not going to his sense of ethics. I mean, he could have done that as well, but he went to a law firm. He wanted to hear the detail of how legal arguments might be made one way and another. Here's Johnson & Johnson CEO Alex Gorsky.
I remember calling our chief counsel that night, and I said, you know, I'd like you to talk to a law firm and actually have them argue the opposite point of view. So we actually went outside the company. And what I found through that process was we ended up staying in the right decision, but it made sure that I think we had much more confidence and conviction in the particular position that we took by taking that pause.
Talk to the lawyers. Maybe that's the way to go. But what about just looking at the law? What about just straight to the ethics? Clayton in Ewan, Michigan. Thank you for calling, Clayton. You're on the air with Steve Brill.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, first of all, and I'm not trying to make any kind of anti-government speech here, but you'll notice that a lot of the pharmaceutical companies, they're not creating cures. They're creating customers. And in the specific case of ADD, ADHD patients, including the children, which is what really grinds my gears, is the children in these cases, a lot of the medicines that are prescribed to people on a broad spectrum are narcotic substances. They're addictive, including ADHD medicine like Vyvanse, Adderall, Ritalin. In fact, the generic form of those medicines is dextroamphetamine. It's an amphetamine. So you get a kid that's 10 years old, and, for example, my cousin was 10 years old when he was prescribed Adderall. 8 years later, 8 years of taking this amphetamine, his insurance, because he had basic insurance, told him that they're no longer going to cover it because it has a high level of abuse in adults.
Okay.
And so he started having to pay for it out of his own pocket, $380 a month.
Yeah.
And you give a kid an addictive substance for 8 years, especially an amphetamine, which is basically crystal methamphetamine, they're not going to stop taking it after 8 years. And that is the classic example of how they're trying to generate profit rather than actually doing something for the individuals with the issues.
Clayton, let me pick the point up right there. You say creating customers, not cures. That can be tricky territory. Point
well,
taken there.
Yes,
Steve?
There's a chapter in, you know, among these 15 chapters that deals with exactly that issue, where Johnson & Johnson goes to Harvard and Mass General and creates a center for the study of bipolar of behavioral disorders in children. And their goal, the FDA has just told them, we don't think the behavioral disorders you're describing in children are actual real disorders that merit a drug. So they enlist with a lot of money the academic community to make the argument that yes, these are illnesses that need a drug, and in effect they're doing what the listener hypothesizes, which is creating demand for a drug by creating a diagnosis that the FDA says to them at the start isn't a real diagnosis.
Steve, stand by. Our callers bring witness in a pretty amazing way. Michelle in Nashville, Tennessee. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi there. I was on Risperdal for years. I went on it because I had a mild facial tic and a doctor prescribed it.
Okay.
And I tried to go off of it a few times, and it was so difficult that I just kept on taking it and taking it. And then eventually a neurologist said, get off of it. I eased off of it bit by bit by bit as long as I could. The minute I took that last dose, I went into a terrible withdrawal. Insomnia like I have never had, extreme dry mouth, dizziness. The worst of it lasted a year. It's been 2 or 3 years now, and I still have problems.
Michelle, was that an off-label use? This is an antipsychotic. You had what you describe as a mild facial tic.
I am not psychotic. I had none of those issues. I had a facial tic, and he said to take it for that.
Can you tell Steve if that was an off-label use? Now, this is not your young or senior.
I'm pretty sure it was. It sounds like it was. Now, remember, doctors, first of all, have a legal right to do that. Second, it happens a lot, and if your doctor knows you well and you trust your doctor, that's one thing. Now, for all we know, the doctor involved, because there are thousands of doctors like this who I talk about in the docu-serial, there are thousands of doctors like this, that doctor could have been on a consulting fee, speaking fee basis with Johnson & Johnson, and he might have known that the more prescriptions he hands out for Risperdal, the more likely he is that they're going to keep him being a paid speaker at their seminars. Now, I know nothing about this case. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that that is part of what was going on. So that undermines, now that I've said it, that sort of undermines your trust in your doctor. One of the little noted provisions in Obamacare now requires drug companies to reveal online which doctors get which speaking fees and consulting fees and everything else. But that wasn't going on when they were marketing Risperdal. And let me just come back, if I may, to the portion of video you played of Mr. Gorski,
the CEO of Johnson
& Johnson. Particular issue he was asking his lawyer about, but I can't imagine that he would have gotten the answer he wanted if he'd asked his lawyer about, can we start a separate Risperdal sales unit called the Elder Care Sales Unit at the same time that the FDA is telling us don't try to sell this to the elderly.
But they did it. I mean, they just did it.
Yeah. So I don't know what, maybe he's had an evolution in his, his thinking and his moral compass.
Or maybe he listened to the legal arguments and decided, well, yeah, there's a risk here. But, I mean, your main point is that the profit was sort of overpowering anyway. Neil in Cleveland, Ohio. Neil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a physician scientist, and I have an adult son with autism.
Okay.
And I just want to say that Mr. Brill's investigative journalism in this regard is great, but it understates the case. Every one of the major pharmaceutical companies, I suspect, that has psychotropic drugs as part of their main profit line, has been guilty of off-label marketing. There were huge settlements against AstraZeneca for Seroquel, against the company that makes Zyprexa. I don't remember which one that was.
Eli Lilly. Mm-hmm. That's Eli Lilly.
And this is a problem that includes the psychiatrist, not merely in the sense that some of them are on the take, but psychiatry, to put it in the words of Leon Eisenberg, a great psychiatrist now deceased from Harvard, who said that in the Freudian era, psychiatry was brainless. Now it's mindless.
What does he mean by that, Neil? What does that mean?
Well, in Freud's time, they didn't focus on any of the biology. It was just talking to the patient and behavior.
Yep.
Now, all it is dispensing drugs, the effects of which are never as precise as advertised. And almost all of the drugs currently used for autism that I'm aware of, that my son has been on, including Risperdal.
Yeah, okay.
Were designed for, or if that's even the word, they were found to be useful for and approved by the FDA for schizophrenia or bipolar disease or depression and possibly anxiety. And many of these drugs have multiple effects, and many of these drugs have as side effects the very symptoms they're designed to address.
So we're off the map in all kinds of directions, but you're a physician researcher, Neil, scientist. Is it possible that the FDA is just too narrow in what it approves for? People who have problems are looking for solutions, or is this just letting things sprawl where they should not go?
Well, that's a complex question that goes well beyond a simple answer.
Yep.
I think the problem is that, as Mr. Brill has clearly identified, the profit motive drives their decisions, and many psychiatrists are only too willing, even if they're not being paid, to dispense drugs that are of dubious value, that take weeks to months to assess in terms of their effectiveness, and that inevitably have awful side effects, not just cosmetic effects like breasts, which are socially horrendous for
46
a young
double
boy.
D on this young boy.
I understand. Yeah. But many of them have side effects like Zyprexa and Seroquel that are devastating metabolic derangements that lead to heart disease and diabetes.
Neil, I appreciate your call.
Yeah, they found that with Risperdal as well.
Steve Brill, you mentioned that there's a push on now to put this kind of marketing in the same category of protected speech, I guess, or whatever you want to call it, as the Citizens United parallel here.
Well, corporate free speech.
Yes.
The drug companies have increasingly made the argument, and as I was doing the reporting of this article and spent hours with the Johnson & Johnson lawyers and talked to some of their board members, one in particular, they make the argument that if a drug company feels passionately about a drug and thinks it'll help people, why don't they have the First Amendment right to tell that to doctors? And if you do that – now, you can criticize the FDA, and I do, but the logical extension of that argument is basically – and and this is something that that a lot of libertarian conservatives believe and believe sincerely – the logical extension of that argument is that you really don't have a regulatory system in this country.
I mean, why not just bring back sincere snake oil salesmen in that case?
That's how these laws came to be, which is that there were, the FDA, when Teddy Roosevelt wrote the law that became the FDA in the early 1900s, it was about snake oil salesmen. And in the 1960s, it was about thalidomide and drugs like that. And that's why we have a regulatory body. Now, you can say they don't act quickly enough. They act too slowly. They act too quickly. Whatever you want to say. But the argument now is becoming we, the drug company, you should rely on us to be sincere. And then their fallback is, and if we lie to you and if it turns out the drug is bad, you can always, bring a lawsuit. But then again, these same conservatives are the people who are arguing day in and day out for the kind of tort reform that would make lawsuits like this really impossible.
And anyway, who wants to live in a country where that's your where nobody has your back except potentially some kind of big suit like that? Richard, Block Island, Rhode Island. Richard, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. It seems to me since these fines and penalties are a cost of doing business, and over and above those, there are such tremendous profits, that the only way really to stop this practice would be to require these companies to, like is done in other fraud cases, financial cases, where there's an obligation to completely disgorge what you've gotten illegally. Why shouldn't they be required to disgorge their profits in entirety? That certainly would stop this practice.
Well, I agree with that, but let's stop and think about that. I'm not sure that's enough. I think individual responsibility is the key to any criminal justice system.
What do you mean? I mean, we just had a peanut butter executive sentenced to 28 years in prison.
But that's the point. It was a peanut butter executive for a company that no one's ever heard of. It wasn't for the kind of blue chip company that can hire the best lawyers in the world. That actually makes my point. He is the exception that proves the rule, which is that peanut butter executive. I guaranteed you that the charges when the government brought them against Johnson & Johnson in terms of the number of people who were grievously affected by the misbranding of Risperdal are a lot higher in number than the number of people who were grievously affected by his peanut butter. But he's a small fry. The issue is if I rob a liquor store and the police catch me, they don't say, okay, now you got to give back all the money you took from the liquor store. They also put me in jail. And if I burglarize a house, they put, you know, I'm individually culpable and responsible, and there's a stigma associated with, I mean, that is the basis of a criminal justice system. That is the basis of the principle of deterrence, that something will happen to you if you do something bad that will deter you from doing it again. Again, I mean, I hate to pick on poor old Mr. Gorski, but the government says he did all these bad things, and the result is he's the CEO of the company. And as I point out at the last chapter, every single person involved in Risperdal advanced their careers.
We've only got a few seconds here, Steve. What's going to decide if this off-market, off-label marketing is corporate free speech or not? Is that going to the courts now, or
it's there are all kinds of cases rattling around the courts right now as we speak. But the smoke signals from the Supreme Court on some semi-related cases they've decided recently is that corporate free speech looks like it may carry the day.
Heads up, America! Watch out. Steve Brill's big expose at Huffington Post is America's most admired lawbreaker. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. He's joined us today from New York. Stephen Brill, thank you very much for all of your work.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.